Hi, good morning and good afternoon to you, John, and welcome to Online with an Architect. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Josh. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. So today, informal chat, we're going to talk about all things architecture and VCDX and a bit about you and the role of an architect. So let's start with some quick introductions. My name's Josh Hodges. I'm the CEO and founder of End-to-End Enterprise Architecture, which is a consulting practice bridging the gap between partners, customers, and vendors. And John, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is John Arashid. I am VCDX number one. I'm also a field principal working as a core solutions architect at VMware. This is actually my second time at VMware, having also done a little bit of time in between at EMC, Dell, VirtuStream, and an interesting startup tied to AI.
Fantastic. Well, plenty of experience between the two of us, I think, so should be good fun. Yeah. So I thought we'd kick off, being that you're VCDX number one, which I'm very envious of. Can you tell us a little bit about what VCDX is?
Sure. This is going back well over 10 years, VMware was looking at how do we ensure consistency with architecture and the designs that support the architecture for infrastructure. And what we found is there was a lot of inconsistency. Yes, there are a number of methodologies that are out there. They all have great value, but we wanted to find a way to capture the essence of an architect. What do they do? What's the pre-work? What's, you know, during a project? What do they do? And any follow-up after that to get some consistency. And we looked at several other vendors that had architecture certifications. Cisco had one, not the CCIE, but a Cisco certified architect level cert. Microsoft also had an equivalent certification for architects. We did an evaluation of what was the cost, what was included in all of that, and we tried to find a way to find a more affordable approach. So instead of having something that costs well over $20,000 to get an architecture certification, we wanted to bring that down. And of course, people may argue that it might still be expensive, but the bottom line is you need to have individuals that are going to be doing the testing in person. We feel very strongly about in-person versus remote because of the interaction that you have with somebody. So for example, if you were doing a defense of your architecture background and it's in person and you're using a whiteboard and you're talking, and there might be facial expressions, maybe a candidate who's doing a testing may look at an individual. This has happened to me before. They looked at me and I may have shown something on my face like I didn't understand, you know, something that triggered them to be able to say, oh, hey, wait a minute, do you want me to go in a little bit deeper? There's just so much interaction that can happen differently in that case. But as we developed this program, it wasn't just about doing it in person. It's like, what are the right number of judgment criteria for the design that's put in front of the panel, how they explain it, their design decisions, and any other relevant information. And what we did is we started coming up with a blueprint for the VCDX program. And this is something that the previous people that I've worked with, some of them had gone over to Nutanix and other companies to actually develop similar approaches. And I think this is what's worked out really well. A lot of the people that took advantage of these different certifications have a consistent approach. Because of the commonality across all these different people from different companies, not just the companies that are developing the certification. I think that's been very positive. The one thing that I do find especially valuable is making sure that somebody who is in an architect role is also looking at all of the details on the customer and making sure that any assumptions are confirmed before they make a decision. And these are just some of the examples that we looked at in putting this program together. The biggest challenge we had in the early days is we'd never done this before. We had a few people who'd worked on it at other companies, but nothing really to help us. And so there's been an evolution over the last 10 years or so that we've had the program in place. And the same thing happens with some of the other companies as well. But our ultimate goal is to ensure an architect who's working with a customer, a partner, or even internally at my company are doing the best on creating a consistent approach that can be validated, tested, and give you the best chance for success in the final output.
Yeah, I think that's the key. It's delivering a consistent outcome for customers. And you're right. Unless there's a methodology and something's followed, it's going to be random, it's going to be inconsistent, and the outcomes will vary. So I think that's a good point. For those listening who are not sure what we're talking about with VCDX, do you want to quickly explain what the acronym stands for?
Sure. It's the VMware Certified Design Expert. And basically the idea is we're trying to do a test or a certification that evaluates if somebody has the minimal qualifications to meet that certification. And what I mean by that is that we're not trying to pick individuals that are at the low end of a range of skills. What we're looking at is, if I have a VCDX and I have this methodology and I'm working with you, Josh, before you had your VCDX, I should be able to feel that if I am passing it on to you, if you were to get that minimally qualified level or above, that you could take what I have, even though you don't know everything about what I've put in the design, but you would know enough how to research, get the answers, talk to the right people, and so on, to be able to be consistent on that and be able to trust that if I turn the design over to you as another VCDX, you have at least the minimum qualifications, and hopefully some specialty areas where you have some deep dive to actually make sure that you can be successful on taking over a project or a design.
Yeah, I think that's the key point that some people might not understand about these type of programs is the certification is saying that you are minimally qualified or more to perform the job. It's not saying you're the best in the world. It's not saying you know anything to that effect. These are the skills we believe are required to do the job to a high standard for a Fortune 1000 company. I think that's the key point. So for a very small environment, okay, some of these skills might not be mandatory, but overall, if you want to deal with any customer anywhere in the world, these are the minimum standards that a person should have to be able to perform the role. So yeah, I think you've nailed that one. And obviously and all I know, of us you know, get VCDX and we try and extend our skills well beyond that minimum standard, but obviously we want to maintain that standard.
I'll give you an example of one of the things that we've used in the program that I think is very important, and it's something that's adopted from other industries. And in this particular case, it's the construction industry. And when you're a builder, what you want to do is make sure that you don't have to go back and do rework. And because the cost of doing a design correctly initially versus doing rework later on is much more expensive when you do that rework. So there's a standard phrase that's used in the construction industry called measure twice, cut once. Because if you have to cut twice, that could be double the cost or some increment more than if you had done it right the first time. And that's something that I think is important. There's a lot of other things that people have coined to kind of help people think about this better. And that what it means is we do want to fit the timelines that are given for doing a design. We also want to make sure we're fitting what the customer is asking for. But in a VCDX or one of the other architect certification areas from other vendors, we all want to look at how do we ensure that there's no risk for failure. And that's where we want to ask additional questions above and beyond what the requirements are from the customer to make sure the design is accurate, it's secure, it's recoverable. There's a set of acronyms we use in the VCDX program that I think is also being adopted. We just pick these as kind of the five high-level areas. Availability, design for availability, manageability, security, availability, and security. It's not necessarily in that order. I normally would look at security first because that's a very important thing that you want to factor in. But everyone has their own slightly different approaches on where to start, and each project is going to be a little different. So you may focus on one area first. It might be manageability and performance, maybe. That might be one area. But all of those end up being, top levels with a lot of further breakdown below that in specific areas, networking security, storage security, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. So can you tell us about your involvement creating the program and how it was built up and how difficult that I'm sure was?
When we initially got started, Melissa Tweet was our fearless leader who actually got us started. She brought in, I think, Alpine Testing and a number of other companies to help make sure that all of the people working on this had the right training. And one of the things that we learned very quickly is we want to test for the minimally qualified, not the maximally qualified. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. We all have different skills, all different experiences. We wanted to figure out what that baseline is. Now, my involvement was in the early days when I was working in professional services and doing consulting, doing architecture design, and so on. And it was myself and it was almost a dozen people total in the early days that were working on providing input. I think the final group that worked towards the tail end was around maybe eight or nine of us. And then we had the original seven or eight people who got the first set of VCGX certifications. My interest in this was looking for consistency, working with a lot of customers where they would make some guesses. They would assume that assumptions are enough to go forward on a design, but then they ended up in risky situations. Yeah, they missed something like, oh, let's develop a data center on the first level of this building that we've just acquired, but not looking at, oh, there might be a swimming pool upstairs, or there might be pipes that are running through the roof. How do you protect about all protect against all these things if you're in what's called a brownfield, a non-greenfield environment where you have to use existing infrastructure? And that infrastructure could be in a building that is old enough that you have to do some major major rework. And this is an example. If you go back just 20 or 30 years, there were buildings around the world that people moved into where all the networking cabling before they had, and this is going maybe a little before Wi-Fi, were on the inside of the walls because they had brick and mortar. You know what I mean? So they had no way to put it in the wall. But that's going back a little bit. But we have other issues that we also have to deal with around security that we have to think about as far as putting together a design that will be robust and also factors in regulations, you know, regulatory compliance and other internal guidelines that they have. But once again, going back, we had the initial group of people doing the testing. And right now, the current panel is three people that are the panelists who do the scoring. And then there might be observers. And then there's a person who moderates the actual event. When we initially did it, we had seven people on the panel. And that's when we were testing for maximally qualified. And that's when we started learning about where we would limit the number of people who could do this job and be successful getting the VCGX at the minimally qualified level. And that's why we made that final change to actually ensure that we could get more people in without degrading the value of the certification, meaning that minimally qualified person I could trust. No matter what my background is, I know I could hand it off to that person and they could take it on and continue.
Yeah, I think that's the key. The certification should deliver a level of trust where people can be confident that anyone with that skill set can deliver a great outcome. A panel of seven, I can guess who those seven people were. I imagine that was fairly intimidating to be presenting to people of such talent.
Yeah, I'll name a couple because I think people will know them. Duncan Epping, he got the 007 number. Mustafa Khalil was number two. There are a number of other people that are in there. I've got them listed out. You can see them online as well. So, but everyone contributed, and I'm not going to say that we all agreed on every topic. Just like in any discussion around architecture, or how do you validate somebody's skill sets, we're all going to have different opinions based on, you know, our background and our experience and our training.
I think that's great, though. Let's get a room of experts, disagree on some topics, and work out where the middle ground is and try and improve each other. So I think that's great.
It can get heated sometimes. Architects are very passionate, too. So
Not me. I'm never confrontational at all. I'm a very subtle guy. Very cool.
Yeah, but that's been the key thing. And that was 2008 was when we actually announced those first seven or eight people that got certified, but they all completed their certification in 2007. We were still working through all the details to make the announcement, but we actually started on this program much earlier. I'd say it was around early 2005, I think, that we first started working on it. So it was at least 2 years, if not longer, before those first VCGXs, you know, got their numbers.
Yeah, and I think you touched on a point earlier about Alpine Testing, who are a testing company, and they actually help create scoring rubrics and, you know, in a very mathematical, scientific manner. So at Nutanix, we did the NPX program. Obviously, we took VCDXs as huge inspiration for that. And yeah, Alpine really helped us understand how to test, what the metrics were, how to score, and how to make sure that you're being fair as well. So it can't be based on just Josh's opinion. It's got to be the panel. We've got to largely agree. If there's a difference in opinion by a significant number of points, then we would have to review why there is that discrepancy in scoring.
And I think both the VMware and the Nutanix programs take a similar approach on some of the ways that we look at how we're going to do that testing, how we're going to actually ensure that consistency. But one of the things that I found really valuable was having that one company providing that feedback based on their experience and giving us the definition of what a minimally qualified candidate was really made it much, much easier to go through that process.
And I think it's important. When we did that, it was very, very eye-opening, actually, to see how to measure something and do it consistently. And as I was a panelist with NPX, I learned quite a lot.
I have a question for you because I'm kind of seeing if it was similar. One of the things that we looked at was when we're going through this process and we're looking at the data that supports the test questions, one of the feedback we got is the information, the answers, the questions and the answer or whatever information should be in the classes that are recommended in the blueprints for the exam or the classes that are recommended for taking or somewhere published. They wanted to make sure that they have the defendable or defensible aspect of having that evidence that, hey, all this information is available. There's no secret area to go to try to find out where the answers are, but you do need a study. You do need to go through the lessons, look at the blueprint and make sure it's aligned. And I think that's where a lot of the companies have been successful. And unlike what we've seen with Cisco and Nutanix on the architect, not the engineering, but the architect certification, they dropped those programs a few years ago. And I think it might be that we've learned, VMware and Nutanix and a few of the other people that are doing some of these architecture certs now, have learned a lot from that, from the lesson of minimally qualified versus maximally qualified. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I do know that those other two programs no longer exist. But there's a lot of times comparisons like with CCIE. I think it's fair to look at a comparison of VCDX and CCIE, but one is more for the hands-on once you've got something implemented versus the architect degree they had in the past that was more on the design aspect and less on the implementation. You still have to factor that in. Mm-hmm. But there's overlap, but there's also some differences between the admin and the architect.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's key. CCIE is a fantastic program. I wish VCDX and NPX had scaled to that same size. I think that would be an amazing outcome for customers. CCIE to me is a bucket over here of expertise, very hands-on implementation and a bit of architect. As you say, there's an overlap in the middle and then there's the architect, on the other side. So I think CCIE and VCDX and NPX may be arguably equally difficult, but they're difficult in different ways. Exactly. And they're testing for different skill sets. So, very valuable skill sets nonetheless. And to your point, absolutely, Alpine Testing were a very eye-opening company in terms of how they go about things. The defensible piece, so if someone was to, sue Nutanix or sue VMware for failing, it would be very easy, actually, based on my experience building that program, to show where that person was good and where that person needed to improve. So, to your point about public information, that's very important. We can't expect someone to know something that an engineer's just coded last week when it's not publicly available. So if someone was given a question and I might have known the answer because I was an internal staff member, I don't expect them to know the same level of detail. I expect them to know what's advertised and available and public. And after the fact, if we discovered information that was probably necessary, we would make sure it got published. So we might, exclude that from the scoring criteria. So it was actually a very educational experience being a panelist. So I think I probably got more as being a panelist than I did as an applicant. The applicant piece was, I think, easier than the scoring piece.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, good fun. Architect capabilities was on our list to discuss. I think, there's a lot of different types of architects and job titles out in the market. And the two probably most common, I would say, is enterprise architect and solution architect. And then you might have principal or senior or something mixed in. But you know, to me, an enterprise architect is more focused on the business side, on the processes, and the solution architect is more on the technical side. But I think the piece that is missing in the market is a person that can do both. So I think VCDX and NPX level people are those individuals that can typically do both roles, because there is quite an overlap. A VCDX on a more technical side needs to consider the business aspect. But a lot of the time, the enterprise architects lack the hands-on skill. And sometimes that's not a problem because they have colleagues who can obviously perform those tasks. But to me, I think ultimately my goal, whether it's realistic or not, is to be able to cover enterprise and solution architecture. What's your thoughts on that?
I agree with you on that. So in my prior roles, I've been either CTO, you know, type of a role when I worked in Octo, but I also worked as an architect. My current role, since returning to VMware, is a field principal and solutions architect. So exactly to your point, having both of the skills of the VCDX, the design methodology, or an NPX design methodology, but plus also the sales side, I think is very important. And I can't say specifically that one is easier or harder than the other because it depends on the individual, their background, their experience, and so on. For me, it seemed to be a fairly easy ramp up. I'm still learning a lot on the sales side, but I still have my VCDX hat on in all of my discussions just because that's been so part of, you know, part of what I've done. But it also helps me build more of, I think, a stronger trusted relationship by kind of focus on those areas. You know, be specific, give the evidence on why you're making certain recommendations, and give the tie-in on what the problem is that you're trying to solve for the customer. And it's not necessarily a problem. They might want to have something that's improving performance or whatever. We may not call that a problem, but it is in a way. I label it under kind of a list of problems to solve for the customer or certain things that they need to get done. And by doing that, you can make sure that you don't run into an issue later on, especially when a customer gives you minimal information. Or maybe it's not a customer. Maybe it's an internal person that you work with as you're doing a design. How do you make sure you do that right? Now, on the solutions architect side, in my space at VMware, we're focused as a solution architect more on the sales opportunities. So we look at the strategic value of something. We look at then applying what are the technology solutions, and not just from a product standpoint, but looking at integration, not only with other of our products, but also third-party products that the customer has, and potentially looking at other things that the customer has down the road. And there's a term, I'm not sure if you've come across this before, but we use this internally for a solutions architect versus a VCDX. A solutions architect develops something called a future state architecture, and that future state architecture is done with the customer at looking at the areas that they're looking at either adopting or have an interest in. So for example, many customers are interested in AI, especially now that there's generative AI and large language models. The question is, how do you get started? Because this is still, it's fastly growing on something that, although it's been around for a few years, it's only been in the last year or even the last 6 months that's gone through the roof on the interest levels and all of that. And doing the future state architecture is more on strategy than on all of the technical details. The VCDX design is on the technical details. The strategy's there, it influences the design, but you've got a architecture, you've got an operations guide, an installation guide, a test plan, and all of that. A future state architecture says, look, these are the business problems, challenges, and things that the company wants to do. And then we look at the current state of their environment. Are they underloaded, overloaded? Are they already virtualized? What's their consolidation ratio? What are security concerns and so on? And then what we do is we map out a multi-phase project process over the course of anywhere from 1 to 3 years. Typically it's 3 years because there are going to be some that are near-term requirements and some that might be longer, or the iffy items. You know, for example, if you're going to start using the elements of cloud, but you don't want to go to cloud, then maybe you focus just on those elements. But if you have an interest in cloud, then we now need to start talking about the different cloud vendors, The companies that we've worked at have been cloud vendors, are cloud, you know, or working with cloud vendors. So we have to factor all of that in. I think that's the key thing is, what is the level of detail and what is the purpose of that design? The VCGX or NPX design is, once that's given to a customer, they can implement it, they've got a test plan, and they should be confident because the evidence should be in there on all the design decisions. The future state architecture, you have the supporting evidence, but it's not as detailed. It's typically a PowerPoint only, not
it's more
a
conceptual
set of,
than logical or physical.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, so I think that's probably a good segue. So an enterprise architect is really looking conceptual. A VCDX or a solution architect might be looking more physical. And then the logical is probably where things overlap significantly.
I think that makes sense. Yep.
So I think.
And by the way, just like with any discussion on architecture, some people may have slightly different variations on what we've just covered. But I mean, I think for the most part, we're all pretty much consistent on what we believe these, you know, these types of roles are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the strategic piece, I think we may have mentioned that VCDX is more on the technical side, which is, of course, true, but also VCDX is very capable strategically as well. With that deep technical knowledge, being able to consider business requirements, map them to technical solutions, and make them measurable, I think is a key point.
There's one thing that I'll give feedback on. For those who are getting NPX or VCGX or other architecture certifications, it also opens the door with the customers or the partners that you meet with. It helps set the bar a little bit higher. And because a VCGX and an NPX not only need to know the technical piece, but they also have to understand all the strategies and some of the strategic thinking by the customer on some of the requirements for these projects.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect summary. And that's one of the reasons I love working with VCDXs and NPXs is they challenge me and they make me better as well. So, you know, obviously it's great being a VCDX. Obviously you were the first back in 2008, I think you mentioned. I think I was VCP 2.5 or 3 in 2005, something like that. So you were already looking at VCDX when I was still down quite at the lower level of VCP. But it's been very good. I think, you know, being VCDX and going through that process, you know, my experience was once I completed that process, I was delivering better outcomes for customers because it was consistent, the approach, which you mentioned earlier. Prior to that, I feel like I was doing a good job, but if I looked back now, I'd probably have a slightly different opinion because it was sort of made up as it went along. But going through that journey meant that I knew exactly what I was doing, when and why. And I actually feel my job is significantly easier now and has been since I got VCDX because that approach, I know exactly what I'm doing and when I'm doing it. No guesswork. Yep. It's easier, less mistakes. Yeah, no mistakes, of course. But, obviously less mistakes. And, you know, I think the hard work that went in only made my life and my job much easier. Have you found the same?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're on pretty much the same background on how we went through the process. For me, I was volunteered to be the first person to test because I had just completed a design 2 weeks prior, delivered it to the customer. It was a pretty big design, and they all pointed at me, oh, John should go first. So, hey, it was the other guys that picked me. But the thing is, we all got to do it at the same time. But, you know, just like you, you know, we've got all the good, the bad, and the ugly on the experiences that we have in any of the projects we do. And it's the collection of all of those that takes time. You can't just build an architecture career on one or two designs. It's an accumulation of all of them because, you know, for example, if I were to hire an architect and they said they've never had a failure or a project that went wonky, you know, I would be a little bit nervous and I would be drilling in deeper because I don't want that person to learn the hard lessons if I'm bringing them on, you know, to take on the role. I'd like to have them have some of that experience because until somebody gets that bad experience, you don't know how they're going to respond. Once you get through a couple of those, it gets much easier and you can start seeing where something might be going down the wrong path and try to do course correction with the project that you're working on.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So, you know, the experience certainly I've had is I see failures before they happen. I see the potential for a risk. I see, and I know from experience what that risk might look like for the customer, what the impact might be. So going through a design phase, or even if I'm looking at an environment, doing a current state assessment, I'll go, I really like to address this before we go any further, because I don't want that to delay the project or cause you an outage. And sometimes I've had people go, oh, you know, you're being a bit paranoid here. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I've seen that like 10 times happen, and I don't want it to happen again. And, you know, most customers are very, you know, willing to mitigate those risks. Occasionally they don't want to. And, you know, it's kind of, it sucks to be right when it's about a customer outage. They do trust
you're,
you.
You're bringing up a very good point here that could be a tangent to another topic area. So
please,
one
fire
of the
away.
Things that that you and I have done, we've worked on one book, and this is where I'm going to go on this. The book that you and I worked on was Volume 1 of Stories from the Field. And the reason why that book was put into place was people were saying, look, we get all this great technical training. We get sales training. We get whatever the training is for our job role. What we don't get is getting the experience of projects or IT horror stories of projects that went the wrong way. And in that first book, and the second book just came out, and these will be available at the VMware Explore event and other conferences that have bookstores. But the idea was, let's tell the story, and we have to anonymize things. We don't want to reveal anything confidential, or we don't want to, you know, run into any potential liability situations. But what we wanted to do was capture the essence of the story, build it out so it's kind of more of a like reading through a novel or a novella, or whatever, and include in there, where did things go wrong? What were the key things that were identified as a problem? What could have been done differently, as well as lessons learned? It's not just what could be done differently, but other things above and beyond that, like choice of team members, addressing problems early before they become big. I mean, things like that. I mean, and I'd love to hear, I know your story, but because we did we anonymized the stories on purpose, I don't always remember the connection of each story. There's a story that I talked about in that first book, which was on a data center that I mentioned earlier, where they inherited an old building. They decided to put the data center on the first floor, but they had a rec center on the second floor. On the first level, there were pipes going above the data center. They had none of those shields that you can get for the top of the racks. It was on a raised data floor with power and networking going under the floor. So if that room flooded, it would be a disaster. And what happened during this one winter, there was a storm. The power went out. The generator didn't come on. And then the power came back later. So what happened was there was freezing and then thawing, pipes cracked. And I don't know the specific details, but somewhere between the pipes and the swimming pool on the second floor, the lower level got flooded. And when that happened, it's not a trivial matter to say, oh, well, we've got all the backups and they're current. Because when somebody tells you, yep, we've got that, and I ask, what was the media that you have this data on? Was it nearline storage online? I mean, sorry, on spinning disk or SSDs? And they said, oh, we got our backup tapes. And I said, okay, how much data you have? It's petabytes of data. What type of format are you using? What do you think their formats were? Out of curiosity.
Well, I can tell you for sure that it would have been a nightmare to get the media, a supporting
no
device
matter what,
to restore it, right? So I think
they
that
had DLT
is the whole story.
8mm and 1/4-inch tapes. So anyone who knows that technology is, DLT is faster than, you know, the 8mm and maybe faster than the 1/4-inch, but they were looking at months to be able to do recovery. I don't know what the answer is, you know, for that final customer. It wasn't my project, but it was something that I answered some questions on related to that. And I thought it was an interesting story. Obviously, we add embellishments because it's not just about the technical details. It's about some of the supporting information about what could have been done differently. Evaluation ahead of time, if they had to put that there, what I would have recommended is change where the data cables are if you can't move the location, and make sure you've got the appropriate disaster shielding for the event of a failure like that. regardless, I still don't think that's the final answer. The final answer would be not having that much of a risk, because it also puts you into a challenge with insurance companies that if you don't have the ability to recover to keep the business going, you end up running into challenges with the insurance company.
Absolutely. I think some risks, it's just not worth getting into, because even if the risk, the likelihood of the risk occurring is low, if the impact is incredibly high, it's just not worth doing.
And so, this is why risk mitigation, risk considerations and risk mitigation is important in any design. So if I was working on a design based on that experience the customer had, the first set of recommendations would be make sure that you have insured safety of the equipment from the things that could damage it, including liquids or some other, you know, other thing that might be a high risk situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the data center considerations at the physical layer are some that are not considered very often. So you might look at a design, and I've done a lot of design reviews for both for certifications and for customers, and very, very rarely is there anything about, you know, what happens if the power's lost. You know, there might be, okay, cool, we'll go to another data center, but we don't want to necessarily go to another data center. We might just want to get the power back on, because that might take 5 minutes, whereas the failover might take an hour. So a lot of the time, backup generators are not considered. You know, the multiple power feeds, multiple internet feeds are often considered. But to your point, like even in the rack, having dual power feeds into a rack, validating that equipment is actually plugged in on the A and the B side. I've been to so many environments where the power went out and they're like, but we have redundant power, but you plugged it all into the same side. Like, that's a very simple test. But if you don't do the test, we can all make that mistake.
It's the same thing when you look at networking. So, you know, there's the concept of the minimal entry point for data and power. So what if you have fiber channel coming in? Oh, I've got, you know, OC3 or whatever the equivalent, because I know it's there's different terms in different countries. But if you have a high-end connection and you've got redundant links, but they go to the one same point that connects to your building, instead of one out one end of the building, one out of the other, then what happens if you lose that point or all the connections that go to that point? And that happened with a couple of different companies that I've worked with. They learned the lesson to have geographically disparate locations for those connection points. And the same thing goes when you look at major power outages in a region. This is going back a number of years when there was a Tesla plane crash back in the this is maybe 15 years ago, I think. It happened in Palo Alto. And when that happened, it took out all the power in the San Francisco Bay Area. So it didn't matter if you had redundant links. They all went down, even some of the ones that had backup power, because not every link in that connection had the same coverage. And that's one of the things that we found at that point of how do we think about different options. You know, now we start thinking about satellite. There's still some challenges, even with Starlink, just because it's, you know, there's a number of different requirements. There's a number of capacity considerations. But, you know, as we go forward, we need to think about all of those areas. There is another point that I did want to bring up, and that is, as an architect, there are many times where you can find that a particular technology that has one use case for a particular customer might have another use case. And I'll give you an example of that. Site Recovery Manager is a tool for doing failover. But if you were to use that tool where you have the hardware for one data center and you have a copy of that data of that equipment that is designed to be used for another data center, you put it in that one data center, you set up replication, you test failover and failback, and then you ship that equipment to the alternate data center. All you do then is you bring up, bring it to the most, the current consistent state by synchronization. Once it's there, initiate the failover. And guess what? You've done one of the simpler data center migrations. Yes, there's a high cost on shipping the equipment, but you can do all the testing without networking, you know, across the internet before you actually do that. And so that's where you can do a lot more testing. You can experiment with things. But I'm not trying to just bring up Site Recovery Manager. It's more of look at the different technologies that are out there, because you may find that when you work with a customer, whether you're on the solutions architect or VCDX or NPX, you might find a way to take advantage of a technology that's new, but it's definitely designed to do exactly what you're trying to do. It's just not marketed it that way, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a million tools that can do different things. So that's a great example. SRM is a fantastic tool. One thing I was going to bring up as well on the failure scenarios is sometimes we get in a situation where we have the backup, we have the data center, it got flooded or whatever. In the same scenario, if we took out flooding and we replaced it with ransomware, cool, we've got our backup tapes. But in the case of ransomware, the equipment is still working, but it's just compromised. So where do we restore our backup? Assuming we have a backup that can actually be restored in a timely manner.
You need to have an independent recovery environment so that you can do that testing, because you don't want to recover a VM into your production environment that might still be compromised. So you might think, oh, you know, we think that this was infected or the ransomware was installed in the last week or so. So you look at maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks before, but that's still not a guarantee. That's why you need that isolated recovery environment to ensure you can do the testing. You can start doing evaluation of things that are not necessarily catchable during, you know, the backup process. The other thing to think about is, as ransomware continues to develop, all companies that are looking at ransomware, in my mind, should be looking at how can we use the underlying layer of software-defined, whether it's networking, storage, or the compute, to be able to catch something before they make an imprint on the disk. Because once it's imprinted on the disk, it's on the backup, and then there's potential risk later on.
And it's exponentially harder to resolve.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So stopping it early is the key to that. And I think,
exactly.
You know, physical data centers, if a customer rings me and says, hey, Josh, I got hit by ransomware, great. I'm in there, I'm helping them out. But they're probably not going to like the answer in most cases, which is we need that independent environment. And the time to stand
because there's
that
a cost rate associated.
Yeah. Yep. So I think one of the things that we don't have to dive too deep in is with the advent of the hypervisor and hyperscaler model on the hyperscalers, I think that is a great way to recover from ransomware.
Yeah.
Because you can actually stand up a net new environment. You know, it's well architected. You know, most of the work is done for you. And then it's really the challenge becomes the connectivity and how to restore the data in there. But 90% of the work is done and you can recover to an environment you know is net new. And actually, if you had production in one of those environments and you got compromised, you could actually stand up another net new environment beside it to restore your backup into as well. So I think that's a really good strategy for people to consider for ransomware.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the companies that are currently looking at ransomware recovery using backup mechanisms, I think they're going to start adopting this if they haven't already. I'm sure that when I go to VMware Explore this year, I'm going to learn a lot more about what all the different vendors are doing in this space. So right now I've been heads down and getting ready for the conference myself. But yeah, I think that's an area that I think more of the different backup vendors and security vendors are going to start looking at. How do we ensure that there is a isolated recovery environment to protect against risk of all the things that could happen if you had it in production or you had connectivity to the internet?
Absolutely.
That might introduce other issues.